Hello and welcome to episode 215 of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong here in Istanbul. Remember to follow Turkey Book Talk over at Twitter/X, Instagram and or Facebook. In this episode, we hear from Andrew Finkel. He is a veteran journalist based in Turkey for many years, and he's now the author of a novel just published by Even Keel Press called The Adventure of the Second Wife, The Strange Case of Sherlock Holmes and the Ottoman Sultan. In it, we follow an intrepid Sherlock Holmes enthusiast and his sidekick, a dazzling Turkish professor, trying to unravel the enigma of Arthur Conan Doyle's dying words, which leads them labyrinth-like into the strange obsession that the late Ottoman Sultan Abdulhamid II had with Sherlock Holmes stories. In the interview, we talk about the book and what inspired it, as well as Andrew's deep experience over many turbulent decades in Turkey, his journalism, his more recent work at the Istanbul Edebiyat Evi or Istanbul Literature House, and much else besides. But before we get started, let me appeal once again for support. It takes a lot of time and effort to read all these books, prepare the podcast, edit it, and put it out there, and I do need listeners' support, your support, to be able to keep doing it. We launched the podcast back in 2015, giving a platform to researchers and authors working on Turkish history, politics, society, literature, and the arts. Turkey Book Talk is completely independent with no sponsorships. It depends 100% on the goodwill of listeners like you. So if you are able to support, please consider doing so by becoming a Turkey Book Talk member on Patreon. Supporting on Patreon is a nice thing to do, and it also gets you some pretty good extras. Those extras include a 35% discount on all books published in IB Taurus and Bloomsbury's Great Turkey and Ottoman History series. As a member, you get a special code to use at the online checkout, which you can use to purchase hundreds of Turkey and Ottoman history titles, either as an old-fashioned physical book or as an ebook. Turkey Book Talk members also receive a PDF transcript of every interview when the episode is published, and you also get transcripts of the whole archive of Turkey Book Talk interviews, including some previously unpublished extras. And finally, to members, I also send links to a couple of articles related to the subject of the episode upon publication, which is ideal if you want to delve a bit deeper. To become a member, just go to Turkey Book Talk's Patreon page and pledge $3, €3, or £2.50 per episode. You can pledge more if you want, but whatever you pledge, membership is entirely at your own discretion. It's inflation proof and there are no strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But enough of all that, now onto our conversation with Andrew Finkel. The Adventure of the Second Wife is a sprawling, playful, highly original read, so I started by asking him to just introduce the novel's concept for us.
Well, the book is called The Adventure of the Second Wife. Ever since I started writing it, I've had two essential premises, bases in mind. The first, which is true, is that Abdulhamid II, the last, I guess, sultan to command the world stage, the last important global sultan, loved Sherlock Holmes and would have the stories read to him before he went to bed at night by his foster brother. This seems such an intriguing image that the shadow of God on earth should like Scheherazade's husband, be listening to adventure stories before he went to sleep. It just seemed to embellish the enigma that was Abdulhamid II. And then to this, I added another premise, which is that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle on his deathbed in 1930, were near the end, was asked which of the Sherlock Holmes stories he liked the best. And he said, well, you know, I hated them all. No one remembers me for my serious work. But there is one story which continues to intrigue me, which is The Adventure of the Second Wife. But of course, there is no adventure of the second wife. And there is, perhaps, you know, a sort of very obsessive Sherlock Holmes community. So for this community, what Arthur Conan Doyle meant was, you know, the mystery. What did he really mean by this story, which no one had ever heard of? And of course, the book tries and solve both enigmas. And it does so in a way that I didn't really anticipate when I started writing. People often talk about how characters and situations sort of, you know, take over the book, and suddenly you find yourself not in the front street seat driving, but in the back seat being led. And that's sort of what happened here. So the book turned out to be perhaps a very different book, I guess, than when I anticipated, sat down to write it in the first place. But I guess that's the fun and interest of it all.
So like you say there, the book charts what you call this obsession with the conundrum of the second wife, and this attempt by the narrator, this Sherlock Holmes enthusiast, This is a narrator, perhaps yourself, I don't know, who tries to solve the mystery of this story, this missing story. Maybe I'm mistaken there. Is there an association of yourself with the narrator? It seems like there's some autobiographical aspects included that also playfully chart how the book came about. So how close to reality were those aspects? Or is that just a kind of game that you were playing? And I suppose linked to that is, how did the idea for this novel first emerge? You know, where did it come from? Was it from that autobiographical aspect? Or is that almost a red herring that you included there?
Well, I guess it's foolish to deny that there's no part of me in the characters in the book, but I certainly hope that I'm not the model for the narrator. He's quite a surprising individual. He too is quite complex and enigmatic, like Abdulhamid II himself. And I suppose, if anything, I'm trying to sort of have a parallel between my narrator and his listeners. But the way I got the idea for the book, there were two sentences which triggered this whole business or which played an important part in the narration. And they were both in parentheses. So they were both passages I came across in other books, but they were, as chance would have it, they were both in parentheses and not really central to the book at all. The one was by Philip Mansell, a historian of the Levant, and he wrote a book about Constantinople. And he was describing what he said was the enigma of Abdulhamid, that he was both modern and traditional, that he would listen to the Quran, but he would also listen to Sherlock Holmes, which he would have read to him before he went to sleep at night. So that passage stuck in my mind, and that was a really powerful image. And another image was something that plays a part in the plot of the book, is that in 1893, Conan Doyle basically has enough of Sherlock Holmes, and he can't stand him anymore, and he kills him. He sends him flying off the cliff tops in Switzerland, and the Rickenbach Fall, and he falls to his death with Moriarty. And that's the end of Sherlock Holmes, and for another 8 or 9 years until Conan Doyle accountant demands that Sherlock Holmes comes back because he needs the money. But the death of Sherlock Holmes was a very, powerful literary event in Victorian England. Anyway, for some reason, I had decided that I would go down to what in those days was the Marylebone Public Library. The Marylebone Public Library doesn't exist anymore, but in its basement was a Sherlock Holmes collection, which they had assembled for the 1951 Festival of Britain. This was their contribution to the Festival of Britain, because it's just around the corner from Baker Street. Anyway, I decided I would go down there, and I wanted to read that 1893, the last Sherlock Holmes story, in an original copy of the Strand magazine, which was where all the stories were first printed, in a sort of unbound version. And I'm not sure why I wanted to do this. Just to get the feel of the tactile authenticity of reading the story as someone might have done for the first time in 1893. Anyway, on the left-hand side is the last page of the story, and there's Watson looking down the cliff at the death of his friend. He finds a letter which Sherlock Holmes has left, and it's this very famous image of the end of Sherlock Holmes. And then on the very next page, is a new article by someone called Rafiuddin Ahmed, who was a very interesting character. It turns out he was a Indian barrister from Pune who ended up tutoring Queen Victoria in Hindustani, and was quite a sort of figure in the late 19th century. A figure at court, was hated by all the other courtiers as for the influence he had over the Queen. Anyway, he wrote this profile of what was then the modern Turkey, and so facing the picture of, the death of Sherlock Holmes is a picture of Abdulhamid II. So suddenly it was like a lightning bolt from out of the blue, telling me I really had to write this story, that I'm a journalist and I thought I was researching a fictional story, and then it suddenly turned out that perhaps I was researching a real story. It was quite a surprise. My jaw dropped and it didn't close again for another few days. I was surprised and dumbfounded by this. But at the end of that portrait of modern Turkey is there's a sentence in parentheses which describes this exhibition at Olympia, at the great exhibition hall in London, that it had been turned into a replica of Constantinople by this famous impresario called Bolossi Caralfi, who the year before it had been Venice, and this year it was Constantinople. And you could take a train to Addison Road Station and have yourself sort of boated in on a kayak, on a boat, into the Olympia Theatre. And twice a day, there was a spectacle, a performance of dancers and singing, and with a cast of 2,000 people. And this too was such a sort of strange and bizarre image of sort of how the Orient was being replicated in West London. That ended up playing a part in the book as well.
You kind of touch on it there. There's a self-consciousness, a playful mixture in the book, kind of mixing, blending fact and fiction. And the novel uses many different voices, time periods, locations. And there's a, like I say, almost a postmodern self-consciousness with the narrator and these perhaps autobiographical elements. Just talk about this sprawling style that you adopt in the novel and what you wanted to achieve through that.
I guess, I mean, I didn't set out to do it that way. My first draft was, I was a third person narration, and then that somehow didn't seem to work. The idea of having an omniscient narrator in a novel where no one really knows what's going on seemed sort of unfair. So I started out with my narrator, who happens to be a doctor who happens to have his surgery on Baker Street. And then it quickly became apparent to me that he really couldn't tell the whole story, that we needed other narrators. And so the book is sort of a tussle between people who want to tell the story and want to tell the story in their own way and get their point across. And in the end, I mean, there is some third person narration. I'm not quite sure who that third person narration is, but it's the idea is that one should get used to the idea of a story without strict boundaries, that there isn't one person telling the story. It's meant to be a story that resonates. And it's not just a story of one decade or another decade. It's a story that somehow replicates itself through the century. And so it's quite complicated in a way. But, you know, again, I say I'm a journalist, and the one thing journalists try not to do is lose their readers. I mean, you try and write so people will read. You know, when I used to teach journalism writing, I said the object is, you know, to get the reader's eye from the beginning of the page to the end of the page, you know, and if you lose them along the way, you failed. So I had this problem of writing quite a complicated narrative, but I wanted to do so in such a way that was straightforward and clear, and that people wouldn't suddenly say what the hell is going on and go back to their lunch or something. The idea was to capture the reader. So it's sort of episodic in a way. There's a lot of self-contained stories within the book, but they all sort of link up. They appear to be self-contained, but they have resonances in later chapters. And so it was quite a puzzle to put together, and it took me quite a while, to be perfectly frank.
And in that playfulness, that almost postmodern style, and of course, that Istanbul setting, there are almost elements, I believe, of Orhan Pamuk in there, if you don't mind me saying. Did that also occur to you when writing, or is that a cliche? Is that a fair comparison, do you think?
Well, when I was a kid, I was on the junior varsity basketball team with Orhan Pamuk, but I think that may be the extent of our his influence on me. I have, you know, read things by him, and I'm not sure that it's a direct influence, but I guess from him, perhaps I took a license that I didn't have to write a straightforward narrative, that, you know, I could write a narrative and it would appear to be a straightforward narrative, but then I could bring in other narrators and bring in other strands. So it wasn't so much that I was influenced him, but he did help to legitimate my ability to do different things and try different things.
So the book is this fast-paced, it has this fast pace to it. The chapters are short and it has this light, playful tone, as we're saying. And struck me as I was reading it, that contrasts quite strikingly with the subject matter, really, because Abdulhamid II in today's Turkey is really loaded with very heavy, serious, ponderous ideological baggage. So there is a nice juxtaposition there between the tone and the subject, indeed, of the book and this image that we have now of Abdulhamid. Could you just talk about that ideological baggage that surrounds him, how he's viewed in today's Turkey? And was it like a conscious effort on your part to cut against that prevailing narrative?
Well, if I may compliment you, that's a very perceptive question. I think the current view of Abdulhamid, of course, is that he, you know, is a great nationalist hero, that he was a defender of the greatness of, you know, the Ottoman Empire in Turkey, and that, you know, he was betrayed by foreigners and by liberals and all sorts of people. But that wasn't really the image of him that was predominant when I first conceived of the book, I think. My notion of Abdulhamid, I think when I started, was of someone who was tyrannical, who basically was responsible in part for, although he tried to save the empire, he ended up running it into the ground. And I think the subsequent generation there, the generations which followed Abdulhamid, the 1920s, the 1930s, the Ataturk generation, as it were very critical of Abdulhamid as the architect of this stale and unprofitable past, which was responsible for the end of empire. So, you know, you have these two very strongly competing views, one of the wrecker and one of the savior. And the way I started was that he was with neither. He was someone who liked Sherlock Holmes, as it were. He was someone human and maybe a little bit silly, that he's someone who listens to Sherlock Holmes under the bed covers at night. So my image of him was very different. And I portray him through other people's eyes as, you know, hero and tyrant. And he's a slightly elusive character in the book. I don't think you really quite get the measure of him, but he is in some ways human and frail and vulnerable, which I show him to be. And this one story anecdote about, which I repeat three times, and each time the story is slightly different. It's told from a different perspective. He emerges as a slightly different character. Although I try to be simple about it, I think in the end it's quite a complex picture that I draw of him, I hope, anyway, where I think. And the other thing, of course, is, as I say, I've said it before, that I'm a journalist. I had the ability to write, you know, columns in, you know, prestigious newspapers and, you know, the New York Times. And I always had the opportunity to write political analysis of, you know, what was happening in Turkey and what I thought should happen, on, you know, express my opinions rightly or wrongly. But there was no point doing that in a novel. I didn't want to write a sort of political novel in which I analyzed what was happening in Turkey at the end of the 19th century. I wanted to write a different sort of story. If I wanted to write political analysis, I could do it. So the story I told was, it's not a roman à clef in that sense. It's not a novel about politics, but it is historical. It begins in the 1890s or even before, and then it goes up to the present and even to the future. And it's sort of a kaleidoscope, I guess.
Yeah, getting to that, you write at one point, and you're here reflecting on Abdul Hamid, this question of his character, what he was really like and what the reality was and what the image of him is. You write that, quote, "We're all so much worse and so much better than we pretend. Abdul Hamid was a cunning reformer who used tradition to sweeten the pill of modernity and then piety to cover his tracks. His empire simmered with revolt, and he tried to fight plague with pestilence and to douse the flames of rebel nationalism with nationalist fires of his own. To foreign emissaries, he complained that his hands were tied by the backwardness of his people, but to the local imam, he blamed the British. He was a man of ambiguity, a loving father who ruled through fear, but was himself too afraid to venture out from behind his palace walls. And he had one clear redeeming feature: he was addicted to Sherlock Holmes." So there, that passage is getting to this idea that, you know, Abdul Hamid II in reality does in fact seem to have been a more complicated individual than some of these mythologies around him. He's not quite the rigid Islamist ideologue of the popular imagination on both sides, which, you know, on one side kind of deifies him, but on the other side demonizes him.
Well, you said it better than I could, perhaps. Yes, that's what I tried to do. But of course, the passage you read is a point of view of one of the characters in the book as well. I mean, I suppose I wouldn't disagree with it entirely, but it has a place and a context within the book itself. I mean, there are characters in the book who take on, you know, who love Abdul Hamid, and there are the ones who hate him.
This book comes after decades that you've spent in Turkey, as you say, reporting on Turkey for the English language and indeed Turkish language various outlets. Could you just take us back to, you know, those previous decades, you know, how you first came to Turkey, how you started working on it? Could you just talk about that, you know, how you first came to Turkey and what you were working on at the time?
Well, I guess, yes, it's the story of a misspent youth, I suppose. I first came to Turkey in 1967. I was, you know, much younger then. Well, I was a young teenager, not even. And I was there because my father was working in Turkey. And we drove out to Turkey in the winter of 1966 and got as far as a tree outside of Sofia and spent a month in a hospital in Sofia in the middle of winter and in the middle of the Cold War. So I arrived in Istanbul in 1967 on the Orient Express. And the Istanbul I first came to then was a city of, I don't know, less than 2 million people. And I came back as an academic in the early 80s, and I came back as a journalist in the late 80s. And the city of 2 million became a city of 5 million, became a city of 8 million, became a city of 16 million. So the Istanbul that I knew as a child was replaced and replaced and replaced again, a bit like the reputation of Abdul Hamid. You know, you try of put your finger on and it dissolves or changes into something else. So I came back as a journalist and I worked for the Turkish press, but I also worked for the foreign press. I had various newspaper strings for the Times and the Economist, and I had a column for the New York Times, and I did stuff for CNN. But I also wrote for the Turkish language press, which, apart from being the easiest way of getting into trouble I knew, was in a way much more fun than writing for the English language press, because, you know, the English language press, I pretty much knew more about Turkey than most of my readers, whereas when I was writing in the Turkish language press, probably all my readers knew more about Turkey than I did. So having to write for the two audiences was fun. I guess it was a like riding a bronco, but I enjoyed it. And I guess to harken back to the book, you know, I'm American, I'm not English, so the idea of these two cultures, which I had adopted, the Turkish and the English, sort of trying to make sense of one another, and it was something I did in life and something I did in the novel, I guess, as well. And then they say journalism is a young man's profession. I guess I'm not that young anymore, and I had good innings. I covered Kurdish refugees, you know, 500,000 people walking up a mountain in northern Iraq at the end of the Gulf War. I mean, that was my first story for the Times. It was quite emotional and exciting and eventful time that I was writing about. You know, I covered earthquakes, and, you know, I wrote about the stock exchange, and I like writing about food and restaurants. So I you know, I've had a good time. I mean, in a curious way, Turkey's been, you know, good to me by being so problematic and challenging me all the time. But lately, I've been trying to pay back that debt by starting an organization which has tried to defend independent journalism in Turkey, which has not always been such an easy task. But, you know, having benefited from being able to write what I wanted, when I wanted, where I wanted, I wanted other people to have that privilege, particularly my Turkish colleagues. And it hasn't always been easy.
As you say there, the atmosphere in recent years has changed significantly from previous decades. Obviously, previous decades were very problematic in their own way and difficult, but in a number of ways, they were also, as you say there, almost great. It was a great time to be working as a journalist. You know, there were so many stories and interesting, rapidly changing political developments. When I first came to Turkey, it was almost a golden era of foreign reporting. I look at it now as those years either side of 2010, it was almost this perfect cocktail of conditions. So there were all these fascinating stories happening, very knotty political developments. There was also a relatively less authoritarian atmosphere in those years, just over a decade ago, and I suppose more space and freedom to work. And of course, the other factor that is not specific to Turkey, but is more general, is that there was this more favorable economic media infrastructure there, at least in the English language press, a lot more outlets commissioning and paying for work, and just a lot more interest, I suppose, in that sense, that could really sustain for many people a decent career. And it seems like all those conditions now, from the economic to the political, have disappeared to a greater or lesser degree. I suppose you've seen that better than anybody, having, you know, been here for a number of years. And it's kind of sobering to think of that, isn't it? Comparing today with those past golden ages.
It is. I mean, I'm reluctant to become too nostalgic. My great axiom is that Turkey and Istanbul is the enemy of nostalgia. The moment you sort of try and dwell in the past, it sort of gives you a swift kick. But I think you're right. I mean, of course, as it was a land of opportunity for a young journalist or a journalist. And of course, the nature of journalism changed too. You know, when I started, there were a thing called newspapers, you know, and people would actually buy a paper and read it. And it was years before I even filed a story on you know, but with email. And of course, journalism itself became devalued by the availability of, you know, information online, that, you know, it was much more difficult to get a newspaper to go and pay you to do something, you know, to go somewhere and do something. Even established newspapers have much smaller budgets now than they did when I started. So I guess it was interesting. Of course, and then I had this additional string to my bow, which was writing for the Turkish language press. I think I possibly wasn't unique, but there weren't more than another handful of foreigners who were working in the Turkish language media. So, as I say, I'm grateful to the opportunities.
And you've been active, I believe, in the Istanbul Edebiyat Evi, so the Istanbul Literature House initiative. That was opened up a few years ago now. It's based in Beyoğlu near Şişhane, Galata. It's this lovely old building, multiple floors, nicely renovated. And it's become this real hub in recent years. It's holding events with authors, talks, Q&As. There's a gallery space over multiple floors, a cafe on the ground floor. What was your involvement in that project? What was the thinking behind getting the ball rolling with it?
Well, we had started this organization called P24, and the point of P24 was to defend and to support and to provide a focus for what we call independent media, for journalists who were, you know, doing the right thing and trying to do their job properly. And so the idea was that this was a time when ownership of newspapers was changing and everything was becoming pro-government, and it was very difficult after Gezi Park. Perhaps you'll remember that journalists started losing their job, and after the coup in 1916, people started getting arrested. So it became very difficult for journalists to really carry out journalism. The cliche, which my colleagues would probably punch me if they heard me repeat it, is that, you know, we set out to defend independent journalism, and then we ended up defending independent journalists who were finding it very difficult to exist and to do their job. So, you know, part of the strategy was really the best defense of freedom of expression is to use it. And we decided that we would be much more of a freedom of expression organization, and that, you know, that we would provide platforms for people to do and say interesting things and to engage in debate and do all the things that, you know, normal intelligent people try to do. And we were getting some support from the Norwegian government. Basically, you have to engage in this sort of activity, you have to raise money, and the money we would get would be from organizations abroad and in Turkey, which shared our goals. And the Norwegian government was quite generous at one stage. And there was this very nice diplomat who talked to us about literature houses in Norway and the importance of these places. And we went and we saw one in Oslo and in Bergen, and we came back and we said, well, we want one of those, you know, that would be a good thing. Of course, it took us a long time to raise the money to open it and to provide the premises. But it's, you know, an idea whose time had come. So it's called Kiratani. And Kiratani is an Ottoman word, which I guess it's sort of a deliberate antiquarian. And, you know, it's a sort of Kirat is discussion and Hani is it's a cafe, basically. It's a coffee shop. And it's a place, in the late 19th century, where people would come and they would read the newspapers and talk about and discuss things. And so the idea was that this would be a place where we could meet and discuss, and it would all be done in an informal way. And to be highfalutin about it, I mean, Habermas writes about the coffee shop as being a, you know, a place of equality where people would communicate to one another as equals. And that there's the tradition of the London coffee houses, with Samuel Pepys dressed up as a Turk going to the coffee house. So that was the idea. We would have talks and people would come. And then, of course, the pandemic came along and suddenly it wasn't so easy to meet face to face. But what we did was we sacrificed that intimacy for going online. And suddenly, instead of having, you know, 50 people in a room, we would have audiences of several thousand sometimes listening in to podcasts and to broadcasts and getting interesting people to talk and inviting authors from abroad. And suddenly, you know, the whole thing just took off. You know, it was very gratifying. I can be boastful about it because I guess I played less of a role in running it than my colleagues, but I certainly am proud of what's been done.
Are you planning to return again to fiction writing? Is there anything on the boil at the moment? Just more broadly, what are you planning to work on next, either in writing or otherwise?
Well, I have two ideas. One is sort of fiction, one is nonfiction. I'm reluctant to talk about them because until I have something real to show for them. But I mean, one of the things I like to enjoy writing about is food and restaurants and trends in food. And it occurred to me that I've been in Turkey for so many decades that I've seen so many changes that somehow I would try and describe these changes through meals that I've had, you know, that the various meals would be emblematic of much larger things, changes in society itself. So I've started sketching that idea, and I do have an idea for another novel, but I'm not going to talk about it until at least I have more chapters under the belt.
That was Andrew Finkel. Many thanks to him for joining for episode 215. Remember, we do need your support to keep Turkey Book Talk going, and you can give that support by joining as a Turkey Book Talk member on Patreon. Membership gets you a 35% discount on all Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus and Bloomsbury, transcripts of every interview, transcripts of the entire archive of interviews, and links via email to articles and other content related to the subject of each episode. For all that, just go to Turkey Book Talk's Patreon account and pledge $3, €3 or £2.50 per episode. Do also rate the podcast or write a positive review wherever you listen. Spread the word, give us a shout out on your social media platforms. Follow via our website, turkeybooktalk.com, our Twitter/X, Facebook or Instagram accounts, or all of them. recommend Turkey Book Talk to a friend or a foe, and I always enjoy hearing from listeners, so do send any feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. Finally, let me once again remind you to check out a friend of Turkey Book Talk, Turkey Recap. Turkey Recap is, among many other things, a weekly email newsletter that brings together all major developments in Turkey over the past 7 days, links to interesting articles, and some excellent puns. They've got a Slack channel for signed up members who want more, and they also publish high quality, original, on the ground reporting. Just go to turkeyrecap.com and follow the links there to subscribe. But until our next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.